Historically, racism has always risen or fallen with the rise or fall of collectivism. Collectivism holds that the individual has no rights, that his life and work belong to the group, to society, to the tribe, the state, the nation, and that the group may sacrifice him at its own whim to its own interests. The simplest collective to join, the easiest one to identify, particularly for people of limited intelligence, the least demanding form of belonging and of togetherness is race. The only way to implement a doctrine of that kind is by means of brute force, and statism has always been the political corollary of collectivism. The absolute state is merely an institutionalized form of gang rule, regardless of which particular gang seizes power. There is only one antidote to racism, the philosophy of individualism and its politico-economic corollary, laissez-faire capitalism. Individualism regards man, every man, as an independent, sovereign entity who possesses an inalienable right to his own life, a right derived from his nature as a rational being. Individualism holds that a civilized society, or any form of association, cooperation, or peaceful coexistence among men, can be achieved only on the basis of the recognition of individual rights, and that a group as such has no rights other than the individual rights of its members. It is not a man's ancestors, or relatives, or genes, or body chemistry that count in a free market, but only one human attribute, productive ability.
Most psychologists don't appear to attach the importance that I do to the role of thinking, to the role of ideas, convictions, judgments, beliefs, values, in understanding motivation. This, of course, is the heavy influence of behaviorism and the behavioristic approach in psychology today. Again, they try to reduce it to the kind of physicalistic level which they can measure and analyze. And without denying that bodily and physical processes are surely relevant to motivation, they miss a great deal because they don't go to the roots. They don't deal with experience, with psychological experience, with values, with preferences, with judgments, with ideas, with convictions. It's the attempt to have a psychology for all practical purposes without consciousness or without mind. Just the trend that I denounced in the self-esteem book.
Like, so focusing on the things that really matter, which is, you know, again, the philosophical principles and clarity on those issues that are really important to, you know, advance our society and make it a real civilization rather than a Stanford prison experiment writ large. And the psychological awareness, the self-knowledge, which entails having that motivation to really work on these six pillars and dedicate yourself to becoming more of who you are.
A new world hangs outside the window. Beautiful and strange. It must be. I found a new way. I must be.
All right, Gloria, please read the first sentence on the board.
Why me?
Because I know how much you love to read. Close the magazine.
Odysseus had no sense of direction.
Now, none of these sentences are correct. I'd like you to rewrite these sentences using proper tenses and spelling on page 4 of your works. What's going on? What is that? Give it to me. What is this?
Just leave it alone.
You think this is funny? Tito, would this be funny if it were a picture of you?
It ain't.
Close the workbooks. Maybe we should talk about art. Tito's got real talent, don't you think? You know something? I saw a picture just like this once. In a museum. Only it wasn't a black man. It was a Jewish man. And instead of the big lips, he had a really big nose, like a rat's nose. But he wasn't just one particular Jewish man. This was a drawing of all Jews. And these drawings were put in the newspapers by the most famous gang in history. You think you know all about gangs? You're amateurs. This gang would put you all to shame. And they started out poor and angry, and everybody looked down on them until one man decided to give them some pride and identity and somebody to blame. Take over neighborhoods? That's nothing compared to them. They took over countries. You want to know how? They just wiped out everybody else. Yeah, they wiped out everybody they didn't like and everybody they blamed for their life being hard. And one of the ways they did it was by doing this. See, they'd print pictures like this in the newspapers. Jewish people with big, long noses. Blacks with big, fat lips. They'd also publish scientific evidence that proved Jews and blacks were the lowest form of human species. Jews and blacks were more like animals. And because they were just like animals, it didn't really matter whether they lived or died. In fact, life would be a whole lot better if they were all dead. That's how a Holocaust happens. And that's what you all think of each other.
You don't know nothing, homegirl.
No, I don't, Marcus, so why don't you explain it to me?
I ain't explaining shit to you.
So you don't even know how we live.
We was here first, man. Shut that shit up, boy.
All right. So what you're saying is, if the Latinos weren't here, or the Cambodians, or the blacks, or the whites, or whoever they are, if they weren't here, everything would be better for you. Isn't that right?
Of course. Yeah. 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 Yeah.
It'd be better if you weren't here.
Right. It starts with a drawing like this. And then some kid dies in a drive-by, never even knowing what hit him.
You don't know nothing. You don't know the pain we feel. You don't know what we gotta do. You got no respect for how we living. You got us in here teaching us this grammar shit, and then we gotta go out there again, and what are you telling me about that, huh? What are you doing in here that makes a goddamn difference to my life?
You don't feel respected. Is that what you're saying, Ava? Well, maybe you're not. But to get respect, you have to give it.
That's bullshit.
What?
Why should I give my respect to you? Because you're a teacher? I don't know you. How do I know you're not a liar standing up there? How do I know you're not a bad person standing up there? I'm not just gonna give you my respect because you're called a teacher.
White people always wanting their respect like they deserve it for free.
I'm a teacher. Doesn't matter what color I am.
It's all about color. It's about people deciding what you deserve, about people wanting what they don't deserve, about whites thinking they run this world no matter what. You see, I hate white people.
You hate me?
Yeah.
You don't know me.
I know what you can do. I saw white cops shoot my friend in the back for reaching into his pocket. His pocket. I saw white cops break into my house and take my father for no reason except because they feel like it. Except because they can. And they can because they're white. So I hate white people on sight.
Ben, do you have anything to say?
Can I please get out of here?
Lady, stop acting like you're trying to understand our situation. And just do your little babysitting up there.
That's all you think this is?
It ain't nothing else. When I look out in the world, I don't see nobody that looks like me with their pockets full unless they rapping a lyric or dribbling a ball. So what else you got in here for me?
And what if you can't rap a lyric or dribble a ball?
It ain't this. I know that much.
Damn right.
And you all think you're gonna make it to graduation like this?
I made it to high school, ain't nobody stopped me. Lady, I'm lucky if I make it to 18. We in the war. We graduating every day we live because we ain't afraid to die protecting our own. At least when you die for your own, you die with respect. You die a warrior.
That's right.
So when you're dead, you'll get respect. Is that what you think?
That's right.
You know what's gonna happen when you die? You're gonna rot in the ground. And people are going to go on living. And they're going to forget all about you. And when you rot, Do you think it's gonna matter whether you were an original gangster? You're dead. And nobody is gonna wanna remember you, because all you left behind in this world is this. You're raising your hand?
The thing that you said before, the Holocaust?
Holocaust, yes.
What is that?
Raise your hand if you know what the Holocaust is.
Come in here, Danny.
Seth.
Relax, let me ask you a few questions.
Oh, man, I'm not in the mood. I got homework to do.
Tell me some of the shit you've learned, fuckass, before I pistol whip you.
Okay.
Who do you hate, Danny?
I hate anyone that isn't white Protestant.
Why?
They're a burden to the advancement of the white race. Some of them are all right, I guess.
None of them are fucking all right, Danny, okay? They're all a bunch of fucking freeloaders. Remember what Cam said? We don't know them. We don't want to know them. They're the fucking enemy. Now, what don't you like about them? And say it with some fucking conviction.
I hate the fact that it's cool to be black these days.
Good.
I hate this hip-hop fucking influence on white fucking suburbia.
Good.
And I hate Tabitha Soren and all her Zionist MTV fucking pigs telling us we should get along. Save the rhetorical bullshit, Hillary Rodham Clinton, because it ain't gonna fucking happen.
That's some of the best shit I've ever heard come out of your mouth.
Danny, no. I feel awesome. Sorry for you, Danny. I know you don't believe any of that shit, right? You don't.
Shut up, Davina!
No, you shut the fuck up.
Man, what the hell are you doing here anyway?
Well, I came to talk about Danny, but we don't have to do that right now. I brought you some books.
Well, what about him? You know, don't keep me in suspense.
He's headed right where you are.
Oh, man. You know what? My mother already laid this trip on me, man. Danny's not my responsibility, you know? What do you expect me to do with that? It doesn't help me. Am I supposed to feel guilty?
I don't want you to do anything. I need to know the truth about how you feel.
Well, what, do you think I want him in here? I mean, I don't know. I don't know what I feel. I'm all... I feel a little inside out. You know, I don't know. There's some things that don't fit.
Well, that happens. Look, Derek, you are too damn smart to be floating around here pretending you don't see all the holes in this bullshit.
Hey, listen, you know what? I said I was confused. I didn't say I didn't believe in it.
All right, that's why you have to stay open. Right now, your anger is consuming you. Your anger is shutting down the brain God gave you.
God, you know, man, you've been talking about what's going on in me since I was in high school. How the fuck do you know so much about what's going on inside me?
No, I know about me. I know about this place. I know about the place you are in.
What do you know about the place I'm in?
There was a moment when I used to blame everything and everyone for all the pain and suffering and vile things that happened to me, that I saw happen to my people. I used to blame everybody, blame white people, blame society, blame God. I didn't get no answers because I was asking the wrong questions. You have to ask the right question.
Like what?
Has anything you've done made your life better?
Today, the American culture is a battleground between the values of self-responsibility and the values of entitlement. This is not the only cultural conflict we can see around us, but it is the one most relevant to self-esteem. It is also at the root of many of the others. We are social beings who realize our humanity fully only in the context of community. The values of our community can inspire the best in us or the worst. A culture that values mind, intellect, knowledge, and understanding promote self-esteem. A culture that denigrates mind undermines self-esteem. A culture in which human beings are held accountable for their actions supports self-esteem. A culture in which no one is held accountable for anything breeds demoralization and self-contempt. A culture that prizes self-responsibility fosters self-esteem. A culture in which people are encouraged to see themselves as victims fosters dependency, passivity, and the mentality of entitlement. The evidence for these observations is all around us. Cultures do not encourage the questioning of their own premises. One of the meanings of living consciously has to do with one's awareness that other people's beliefs are just that, their beliefs, and not necessarily the ultimate truth. The average person tends to judge him or herself by the values prevalent in his or her social environment, as transmitted by family members, political and religious leaders, teachers, newspaper and television editorials, and popular art such as movies. These values may or may not be rational and may or may not answer to the needs of the individual. I am sometimes asked if a person cannot achieve genuine self-esteem by conforming and living up to cultural norms that he or she may never have thought about, let alone questioned, and that do not necessarily make a good deal of sense. Is not the safety and security of belonging with and to the group a form of self-esteem? Does not group validation and support lead to an experience of true self-worth? The error here is in equating any feeling of safety or comfort with self-esteem. Conformity is not self-efficacy. Popularity is not self-respect. Whatever its gratifications, a sense of belonging is not equal to trust in my mind or confidence in my ability to master the challenges of life. The fact that others esteem me is no guarantee I will esteem myself. If I live a life of unthinking routine with no challenges or crises, I may be able to evade for a while the fact that what I possess is not self-esteem, but pseudo-self-esteem. When everything is all right, everything is all right. But that is not how we determine the presence of self-esteem. Genuine self-esteem is what we feel about ourselves when everything is not all right, when we are challenged by the unexpected, when the cocoon of the group can no longer insulate us from the tasks and risks of life. At such moments, our deepest premises reveal themselves. One of the biggest lies we were ever told is that it is supposedly easy to be selfish and that self-sacrifice takes spiritual strength. People sacrifice themselves in a thousand ways every day. This is their tragedy. To honor the self, to honor mind, judgment, values, and convictions is the ultimate act of courage. Observe how rare it is, but it is what self-esteem asks of us.
Campaign violence gone viral. Those are the big questions this week after the ugliest 2 days of a dangerously angry White House race. Chicago Friday night, a Trump rally canceled after protesters clashed with Trump supporters.
Knock the crap out of them, would you? Seriously.
In North Carolina this week, the world saw a Trump supporter do exactly what Donald Trump had called for.
If you're an African first, go back to Africa!
Back to Europe!
You're real twisted as a black man. You look real dumb. Uncle Tom, motherfucker. Uncle Tom, motherfucker.
Get out of America. Fuck you. I'm white. I'm fucking white. I am white. I am fucking white. That's a fucking race.
Yeah, go make America great again. Fucking racist prick.
They're throwing things at the guy who has a Trump shirt on. Oh, he just got knocked in the back of the head. He just got punched in the face. And now they're rushing him.
Protesters followed Trump supporters to their cars as they left the convention center. Around the corner and away from police protection on San Carlos Street, a mob mentality took over.
The higher our self-esteem, the more likely we are to form nourishing rather than destructive relationships. The higher our self-esteem, the more inclined we are to treat others with respect, benevolence, and goodwill, since self-respect is the foundation of respect for others. This last point is something I want to emphasize because so often I am asked, haven't we had enough of the me generation? Aren't you encouraging selfishness? My answer is, genuine self-esteem is not competitive. It's not expressed at the expense of others. It's not a quest to make oneself superior to all others or to diminish others so as to elevate oneself. One of the most significant characteristics of healthy self-esteem is precisely that it is the state of one who is at war neither with self nor with others. Our external life is so much a reflection of what's going on internally. The tragedy of many people's lives is that they look for self-confidence and self-respect in every direction except within. So, they fail in their search.
Bring it! Bring it!
Brother! Brother!
It's one thing to recognize that school does suck in many ways, but then also realize that learning is awesome.
Yeah.
And learning about yourself is really profound. And learning about another person's self is really profound. And that's the nature of relationships, you know? And as we get into this realm of self-learning, then we can really connect in ways that we might otherwise not have connected. So given that this is not a dress rehearsal, as a friend of mine in the freedom movement used to say, it's important to actually look at this most valuable aspect of self-directed learning as something that we take with us as we go along and learn about anything else. And I really like the notion of this came to me from reading this article on Psychology Today that I sent you, The Golden Age of Autodidacts.
Yeah, absolutely. So what really impacted you in that piece?
Well, I just liked the perspective that taking it as a matter of fact thing, that there's some people that have divested themselves and escaped the coercive system of schooling and gone about charting their own path in the realm of learning and excelling in things and living purposefully, basically, that, you know, you can put your mind to things and achieve all kinds of amazing things. And they give examples of people that have done this and wrote little bios of them. And I really appreciated the perspective that this is an avenue for everybody that's open for everybody to do at any time in life. You know, it's never too late to start that self-directed path of learning.
Yeah, it says in the article that even within the stuffiest education system, all learning, including that learning, is really bolstered by self-teaching. You know, I think there's a lot of people, maybe people listening who are stuck in school or even stuck in college, which is also not a great place a lot of the time, depending on what you're studying and where you are and who you're surrounded by. But they would relegate themselves, or maybe there's even parents who are in the unfortunate situation, maybe because of a divorce where they have children who are in the public schools, and they get relegated to this idea that, well, somebody else teaches me or somebody else teaches my children right now. I mean, like that's, I talk to my own brothers who have kids in the schools about, believe it or not, about this all the time. You know, like make sure that they're, if they're in these places and you know these places are certainly, you know, laden with all kinds of problems, make sure they're developing intellectual self-defense. So if somebody is self-aware and self-educating, the public schools and even higher education, quote unquote, becomes kind of like a gymnasium for building intellectual self-defense, you know?
Yeah, it's the milieu in which one can really strengthen the defenses or actually amplify the pillars of self-esteem so that you can have this immune system of consciousness to all these things that are detracting from your self-esteem.
Right.
Because when we're in any sort of power over dynamic where things are being coerced, where we so-called have to do things or else we get punished, then we know that it's not honoring our self-esteem. It is sacrificing it. So to go back to that inner well of these practices is really, really essential, really helpful.
Yeah, the article gave me a lot of hope to for the future, which is hard to muster sometimes with some of the things I see, especially coming out of American universities. But, you know, the author talks about, you know, most of us aren't embracing the current age of access, where we can really, you know, maybe we have to invest some time and maybe we even have to invest a little bit of money, but we can master any topic we want today. You know, this isn't surprising for people who are our age because, as I said before, so much of our learning was done in these settings where we were required to be passive. But if you're 15 or 16 years old, even though you do have to exist in those same poisonous environments, you have never been alive in an age where you couldn't just go out and find something that you wanted to find out, you know, through the internet. So I actually think in a generation, there will be a less passive attitude towards learning generally that I think is a leftover from people our age and people probably our parents' age. I mean, we remember the feeling of like, and Pete Holmes, the comedian, has a great bit about this. Like, do you remember the sense of wonder, you know, when you would wake up in the morning and say, where was Tom Petty born? And there was no way for you to find out. And you just, you know, someday you would stumble across the answer and there would just be this tremendous feeling of satisfaction. But maybe it would be years later after you woke up the morning and first wondered that, you know, first asked yourself that question, where was Tom Petty born? And information is so instantaneous today that even if people are being trained in these schools to be passive learners, they can't help but become take charge, active learners for the most important things, the things they're intrinsically motivated to learn, which I think is great.
Yeah, there is just a danger that this power over domination system of schooling can push kids away from the learning process and into, you know, like the social media stuff instead.
Yes.
And not have that balance that they otherwise would if their intrinsic motivation to learn had been honored from the get-go. But yeah, everyone today has one of these infinity rectangles, you know, and you've got all this information at your fingertips. And so what do you do with that information? And where to find information that's actually going to enrich your life? That's the real key.
So I also liked them. I learned about this character, Blake Bowles. The article talks about his book, The Art of Self-Directed Learning. And a quote that I appreciated, Blake says, "The difference between self-directed learners and everyone else is as soon as school or work stops serving their life goals, they don't stick around. They ditch the well-trodden path, bust out the map and compass, and cut cross-country to virgin territory. Self-directed learners take full responsibility for their educations, careers, and lives." And I think it was the combination of this realization that, yeah, a lot of people aren't really active learners. But, you know, just reading that quote, I said, a lot more people are going to, I see a lot more people becoming this way, you know? Like, I think the number of people that Blake Bowles is describing in that quote has increased by a factor of I don't even know how many, 100,000, once people see the world of opportunity.
Yeah, they can become emboldened by seeing other people do it. You know, I think Blake has run the not back to school camp.
Right.
and where, you know, people are doing all these amazing things outside the traditional systems. And yeah, seeing other people chart their own courses like that is an incentive for oneself to do that. And no one is incapable of doing such a thing, even though the systems try to convince you otherwise, or that you can't somehow have access to various things in your life without, you know, towing the party lines.
You know, another thing that also came up in this article that I feel is worth touching on, even though it could certainly spin off into its own whole series.
Another series.
Is they talk about autodidacts and IQ. And I know this is something that you devoted a bunch of time to with Chris from Choice Conversations recently. This was part of your examination of what's been up with Free Domain Radio over the last couple years.
Yes.
I'm still researching this whole question of IQ. It did come up a couple years ago when I was on a show called Red Ice Radio. They wanted to talk to me about whether I thought, you know, the population was, and this is the problem with IQ, it takes 5 minutes to find a study and another 2 minutes to find a study that contradicts it. But,
exactly.
You know, there's studies that say that IQ has fallen 14 points across the Western population since the end of the Victorian age. And then there's the work of not the guy who wrote the bell curve, but the guy who did all the research into IQ. And
oh, the Flynn, James Flynn?
Flynn, big, beautiful beard on that James Flynn. Yeah. Who says that every generation we're seeing upticks in IQ.
Yeah, so, I side with his perspective on this, in that depending on where you live, what culture you're in, what socioeconomic environment you are in, you will increase or decrease your IQ, which is basically how well you can do an IQ test.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't really like the notion of IQ, the way it's done in tests and measures. You know, I took the stuff in psych in undergrad and graduate, and I was just like, what's the point? You know, I guess if you abandon philosophical principles, then you can spend your time slicing and dicing humanity based on IQs. That's the perspective I have, because it is irrelevant to living a happy, healthy life.
Yeah. You know, relates to the work of Daniel Siegel. And one of the interviews that he did, I think on Rewild Yourself podcast, another link that you sent me and I'll make available for everybody who's listening to this.
Yeah, that was interesting.
They're talking about, they're talking about people in Africa where obviously for whatever reason, or we would think that people wouldn't perform as well on IQ tests, right? And studies have bared that out, that, you know, the continent of Africa is, you know, less westernized, or all these things that would lead to difficulty with the standard IQ tests that were developed in Britain at the turn of the century. And once you look into the history of intelligence testing, there were some pretty nefarious intentions in it, right? There were a lot of eugenicists who were really, really excited about the process of quantifying everybody's intelligence with one number. That was very useful. And, you know, it's interesting, too. I don't want to go off on a tangent. Like I said,
trying
this could
be... Trying to confirm their biases.
Well, in England, everyone was searching for a way to tie IQ. Once IQ was developed, they were searching for a way to tie it to class. But in the United States, at the same time, they were searching for a way to tie it to race. So it's interesting. And why the difference, right? Why class in one place and race in another place or another country? Well, in Britain, they didn't have problems with black people because there weren't any there, right? In the United States, they did, because they were in this very messy period called Reconstruction, or at the tail end of it. What you see in both places, though, and Britain has always been very class segregated, is belief systems in search of science, right?
Yes.
That justify them. Now, I'm
the
not saying...
The pitfall of confirmation bias.
This is a very complex issue. There are even arguments that make sense to me, like, yes, if people originated in places where there were more abundant food sources that were easier to obtain, would they rate lower on the scale because survival was easier than, say, somebody who has an ancestry that goes to Scandinavia? Like, I can understand things like that, but still, summing up a person's intelligence with one number is, I'm not buying into it.
Yeah, that is really, really unscientific.
Yeah,
notion that people in, you know, temperate or tropical climates are just kind of lazy and they don't use their minds, like the people who move to northern climates and all that. Like, it's irrelevant from an anthropological point of view because philosophically, what's important is, can a person make choices and grasp ideas?
Mm-hmm.
And practically everybody can do that. Now, I can see instances of communities that are afflicted by some disease or some heavy metal like lead in the water or something that can really have an effect on people's cognitive capacities, memory, and so forth. But outside of that, we're dealing with conceptual creatures, no matter what their shape, size, or level of melanin in their skin or where they grew up. And they're able to achieve things based on their own individual developmental process, essentially. And that's why it's important to go back to these psychological awareness issues in the six pillars, because if a person can do that and nurture themselves in those ways, the past doesn't really matter and the history genetically doesn't matter because we're all conceptual beings.
Right.
But I can understand, though not justify, anyone's position as to why they try to slice and dice people. There's a lot of fear out there, fear of the other and fear of, different cultures taking over, supplanting one's own culture. And all this is taking the focus off the real problems, which is the systemic coercion that we have, you know?
Yeah, this otherism. And I think it's okay, and I don't know why it just isn't talked about in these terms, I think it's okay to experience something called in-group preference. But when it's turned into gender and race and culture, it becomes very, very sloppy, right?
Yeah, like, I mean, lots of us experience in-group sports teams.
Well, yeah, but I think a lot of us experience in-group preferences to a certain extent. But when these other lines are drawn, it becomes very, very easy to exacerbate conflicts. Right, because these are really like emotional issues, race, gender. But the point, and like I said, I knew I could get off track with this. There has been a big resurgence in this discussion of IQ, especially race and IQ, in the last couple of years, and a lot of it is kind of calling back to science, that science, quote unquote, that was done. And no, I shouldn't say that because a lot of it was science, but it was there was agendas. And there were even people who did good work on the subject of intelligence testing, only to see their work taken and perverted by people who had agendas that related to eugenics. Alfred Binet was the psychologist who was working in the UK. And his research was taken over by a guy named Henry Goddard, who was not only a psychologist in America, but also a eugenicist. So he took the tests, but basically abandoned Binet's principles and methods, and then was able to kind of shift Binet's research to his own purposes, right? Yeah. And his goal was basically like, all right, well, Binet did great work. He gave us a great running start on these intelligence tests, so now we can identify the unintelligent and stop them from breeding. So this ties in perfectly with like the progressive movement of the early 20th century. And Goddard actually wanted to take the unintelligent, once he assigned a number to them, and put them in institutions where he worked and he did research. So an interesting kind of cronyism going on there as well. And what he wound up doing was he would go to Ellis Island during the big wave of immigration. So we're talking like first or second decade in the 20th century. And he would visually identify the unintelligent by appearance. And he would test them. And then that was used to promote a stricter immigration policy, basically.
Interesting. And so what's the definition of intelligence, right? I mean, I kind of outlined the distinctive one in the show that I did with Chris, and we had a geneticist named Kevin McKernan on with us. He was also voluntarist, you know, full-on red pill, freedom-loving guy, and we talked about gene wars, IQ, and immigration. That was, I'm not sure what the number of the episode was, but it was back in January of this year on Choice Conversations podcast. Maybe you can put it in the show notes.
Sure.
But the way I look at intelligence is different than what most psychologists look at it as. I see it as the ability to deal with concepts in a non-contradictory way and the extent to which you can bring awareness to the nature of contradictions and ferret them out. So I've talked with and met various people in Mensa, you know, very, very high IQ. I think there are two standard deviations above the mean.
Yep. 132. And
yeah, I've never encountered one who was freedom loving.
Exactly. Yeah, right.
You know, it's like if we can't figure out that basic idea of human respect between and among people, then obviously what is IQ serving here other than sort of novelty or some sort of status?
Classification.
Classification. It's kind of a substitute for self-esteem, I could see it as. Where people are relying on this as a way to sort of feel good about themselves.
Yeah, but it was also a kind of human zoology that was very, very commonplace in the first two or three decades of the 20th century. And your your definition of intelligence is fantastic. I mean, there, if you go through and you read their work, it's all very, very abstruse. One of the early works on this was called General Intelligence, Objectively Determined and Measured, which sounds like case closed, right? It was written by a guy named Charles Spearman, who was really, really heavily influenced by another eugenicist named Francis Galton, who was actually, I can't believe I'm forgetting this name, but I'm remembering those. Darwin. He was Darwin's. Galton was related to Darwin. And the term they used, I'm not even going to like pull up the quote. I have notes on all this stuff, but he called it G value, which was just something that was fixed, couldn't be changed, real and measurable inside the head. Maybe you could even pick it up by feeling the bumps, doing a little phrenology on somebody, you know. Nice. So by today's standards, superbly unscientific. But this was a mix. It's hard to talk about any large group of people working on a project so massive in scope and say they were all trying to do this or they were all trying to do that. There were people like Binet who really wanted to see if he could discover a way to measure human intelligence to help people. And there were others who perverted that work for the purpose of, you know, promoting xenophobia and promoting eugenics. And it seems like the resurgence in what is often called race realism, and this is something that I've really tried to study up on, and the importance of IQ. And you know, it does even look like there are statistics that would suggest that if you have a lower IQ, you are, you know, I saw one study that said an IQ in this low range makes you 7 times more likely to end up in prison than an IQ that's like, say, from 105 to 115. IQ has been correlated with better outcomes as far as profession, as far as quality of life is concerned. So I don't think it's something that can be entirely thrown out, not from the research that I've done, but it's not something that you can, you know, you group a bunch of people together, you put a range of numbers on them, and then you use that number to basically rank them as a gender or a race or a culture. Like, that's,
and then you can forward your protectionist measures, your fascist policies or welfare status policies, and all those agendas get forwarded through that process, that lens. They're just not taking into account the wider context, obviously. This is the problem with humanity in general right now, is they're dropping the philosophical and psychological context that they need to make sense of it, all this stuff. So because they're not in that realm, that context of mental functioning, they're focusing on these minutiae or these things that are derivative issues.
Right.
And seeing them as significant or the end all be all or something that is more significant than the things that are actually what's meaningful, which is human freedom, human flourishing, this self-knowledge, these practices with oneself that any person can practice regardless of how they do on an IQ test. You know, it's like, there's no reason to really focus on that when all this other stuff is off the rails.
Right. Know? Absolutely.
So it doesn't make any sense to me that there's this focus, but I understand it in terms of, you know, when people get fearful, when there's the in-group, out-group stuff that's going on, when there's this desire to really make sense of oneself in a social context in relation to groups, I guess. But,
right.
Yeah, it's dropping the context of the more important philosophical and psychological processes that we can instead focus on, and you wouldn't even have to deal with any of that stuff. Like, there's no need to slice and dice people like that. I think Ayn Rand called it this is the barnyard form of racism. I can't remember how she phrased it, but she was very disdainful of this focusing on people's genetic lineage and determining whether they're this or that, you know?
I would she barnyard anthropology, perhaps?
Yeah, could be.
Okay.
But she focused on, you know, people's character.
The theory that holds good blood or bad blood as a moral intellectual criterion can lead to nothing but torrents of blood in practice. Brute force is the only avenue of action open to men who regard themselves as mindless aggregates of chemicals. Just as there is no such thing as a collective or racial mind, so there is no such thing as a collective or racial achievement. There are only individual minds and individual achievements, and a culture is not the anonymous product of undifferentiated masses, but the sum of the intellectual achievements of individual men. Even if it were proved, which it is not, that the incidence of men of potentially superior brain power is greater among the members of certain races than among the members of others, it would still tell us nothing about any given individual, and it would be irrelevant to one's judgment of him. A genius is a genius, regardless of the number of morons who belong to the same race. And a moron is a moron, regardless of the number of geniuses who share his racial origin. The question of whether one alleges the superiority or the inferiority of any given race is irrelevant. Racism has only one psychological root, the racist's sense of his own inferiority. Like every other form of collectivism, racism is a quest for the unearned. It is a quest for automatic knowledge, for an automatic evaluation of men's characters that bypasses the responsibility of exercising rational or moral judgment, and above all, a quest for an automatic self-esteem, or pseudo-self-esteem. To ascribe one's virtues to one's racial origin is to confess that one has no knowledge of the process by which virtues are acquired, and most often that one has failed to acquire them. The overwhelming majority of racists are men who have earned no sense of personal identity, who can claim no individual achievement or distinction, and who seek the illusion of a tribal self-esteem by alleging the inferiority of some other tribe. Historically, racism has always risen or fallen with the rise or fall of collectivism. Collectivism holds that the individual has no rights, that his life and work belong to the group, to society, to the tribe, the state, the nation, and that the group may sacrifice him at its own whim to its own interests. The simplest collective to join, the easiest one to identify, particularly for people of limited intelligence, the least demanding form of belonging and of togetherness is race. The only way to implement a doctrine of that kind is by means of brute force. And statism has always been the political corollary of collectivism. The absolute state is merely an institutionalized form of gang rule, regardless of which particular gang seizes power. There is only one antidote to racism, the philosophy of individualism and its politico-economic corollary, laissez-faire capitalism. Individualism regards man, every man, as an independent, sovereign entity who possesses an inalienable right to his own life. A right derived from his nature as a rational being. Individualism holds that a civilized society, or any form of association, cooperation, or peaceful coexistence among men, can be achieved only on the basis of the recognition of individual rights, and that a group as such has no rights other than the individual rights of its members. It is not a man's ancestors, or relatives, or genes, or body chemistry that count in a free market, but only one human attribute. Productive ability. It is by his own individual ability and ambition that capitalism judges a man and rewards him accordingly. No political system can establish universal rationality by law or by force. But capitalism is the only system that functions in a way which rewards rationality and penalizes all forms of irrationality, including racism. A fully free capitalist system has not yet existed anywhere. But what is enormously significant is the correlation of racism and political controls in the semi-free economies of the 19th century. Racial and/or religious persecutions of minorities stood in inverse ratio to the degree of a country's freedom. Racism was strongest in the more controlled economies, such as Russia and Germany, and weakest in England, the then freest country of Europe. It is capitalism that gave mankind its first steps toward freedom and a rational way of life. It is capitalism that broke through national and racial barriers by means of free trade. It is capitalism that abolished serfdom and slavery in all the civilized countries of the world. In its great era of capitalism, the United States was the freest country on earth and the best refutation of racist theories. Men of all races came here, some from obscure, culturally undistinguished countries, and accomplished feats of productive ability that would have remained stillborn in their control-ridden native lands. America had been called the melting pot with good reason. But few people realized that America did not melt men into the gray conformity of a collective. She united them by means of protecting their right to individuality. Racism is an evil, irrational, and morally contemptible doctrine. But doctrines cannot be forbidden or prescribed by law. Just as we have to protect a communist's freedom of speech, even though his doctrines are evil, so we have to protect a racist's right to the use and disposal of his own property. Private racism is not a legal but a moral issue and can be fought only by private means, such as economic boycott or social ostracism. In conclusion, I shall quote from an astonishing editorial in the New York Times, astonishing because ideas of this nature are not typical of our age. Quote, "But the question must not be whether a group recognizable in color, features, or culture has its rights as a group. No, the question is whether any American individual, regardless of color, features, or culture, is deprived of his rights as an American. If the individual has all the rights and privileges due him under the laws and the Constitution, we need not worry about groups and masses. Those do not, in fact, exist, except as figures of speech."
And of course, she herself could have benefited, perhaps, by practicing these six pillars later on in life, after she slapped Nathaniel across the face and never spoke to him again.
Mm-hmm.
That was after, there's actually a whole backstory on that with Brandon's memoir and his first wife, Barbara's biography of Ayn Rand, The Passion of Ayn Rand. They explain what happened there, you know, on the personal side of things, which I found pretty fascinating because I really wanted to see to what extent they integrated these philosophical principles into their lives and how it helped them.
Yeah.
Or maybe even tripped them up a little bit from focusing on the psychological. And that's what Brandon did after he left, you know, the early objectivist collective, as they ironically called it, to focus on the psychological, because there was a really restrictive environment with these philosophical principles that was leading people to disown parts of themselves. So he wrote a book called The Disowned Self to help objectivists deal with this whole emotional psychological world that was kind of being left by the wayside as we focus strictly on philosophical principles. So there needs to be that balance. But you know, getting back to the IQ thing, in the article on Psychology Today, they say standard autodidacts tend to have high IQs, says Jonathan Wee, PhD, a researcher at Duke University who has studied talented youth extensively. Quote, "A lot of research shows that smarter people are more likely to engage in self-directed learning. If smarter people really focus on a topic, they're going to advance more quickly. But across IQ levels, passion makes up for a lot. There are lazy smart people. There is individual variability in every part of the distribution of intelligence."
Right.
End quote. So he's kind of getting at the fact that this IQ thing is not so important, not as important as passion and motivation. And I would say the self-knowledge aspect,
right,
too, to really help person make sense of things.
What Bowles, I think later in that article, calls having a growth mindset, right? Which is both intellectual and personal.
Yeah. Quote, "blessed with a genetic predisposition for independent thought, pattern recognition, and creative problem solving."
Yeah.
They are, in other words, quote, bright. Yeah. I don't know about genetic predisposition for independent thought. You know, we've speculated in the past of what draws people to voluntarism, whereas the rest of the bulk of the population is not. It's interesting to speculate on. That could be a whole nother series.
Yeah. And I, you know, I try to challenge myself and audit some of my beliefs that lead to these explorations of things like the history of IQ. And I'll ask myself things that I don't believe, just to wrap this topic up. Like, what if the progressives were right? And what if they really did realize that, you know, certain people, well, I mean, obviously there's variability in intelligence. That's not something that we could argue with. But I'll create a thought experiment where they were right and they felt like they were dividing people based in a way that would make society work best, you know, and I'll work from there just with that thought experiment. These people, the things they did, throughout the first half of the 20th century with the schools and with eugenics were absolutely terrible. They weren't right in what they did, but what if they discovered something? What does that mean? How would things change? Now, I don't think they did, but I like the challenge of going through the thought experiment and auditing those beliefs. And that actually led me down this path of examining this question of the history of intelligence testing, because these people must have loved that. You know, they wanted this kind of easy quantification for the purpose of sorting people. But I was actually quite relieved by what I found in how sloppy the science was then, and mm-hmm. how what people are trying to bring up today to justify divisions and things like stricter immigration policies, it really is just a rejuvenation of the exact same science, the exact same names, arguments about the size of people's heads, but happening today. There's like subreddits about this. And I dug into it. It's a fascinating topic, but it's fine to, I think, recognize patterns. That's something that we do. I think it's fine to say that culture impacts people's beliefs and people's decisions, but either of those things can't supersede looking at somebody as an individual. And the resurgence of these types of quote-unquote science are giving people a shortcut around that, around examining each person as an individual, because it's a difficult process. It's a time-consuming process. You know, I know we talked about a while back, I was planning a show with Thaddeus, and I came across, two professors who worked at Ivy League schools. Now, when you say two professors who work at Ivy League schools, does some picture start to appear in your mind of what do they look like? Do they... do they have maroon turtlenecks on? Do their sports coats have elbow patches? Do they have unkempt beards? Do you have a bias? Do you have a prejudice that starts to produce a picture in your mind of this person? How do you feel towards that person? And just mm-hmm. being honest about these things is fine. So then, it was the show that Thad and I did was about race. These two professors were Black and they were talking about Black Lives Matter. Well, what other assumptions start to appear in one's mind? Do you think you know what they're going to say about it? Because they might surprise you, and they both did. That was why I used the clip in the show. But these things do happen. People do have these assumptions, and we forget sometimes to take the time to examine each person as an individual, because it's so easy. It's so much easier to not do that. Stereotype and collectivize. Those are super popular things right now.
Yeah, and that leads right into the train wreck of not having human freedom.
Right.
This is the main focus that we need to be on. In addition, it's part of the seventh pillar. The motivation to practice these pillars leads one into the realm of human freedom. So how to make that enticing and welcoming for people rather than focusing on these other issues that really detract from this important journey that we're all on. I mean, It's a really tragic thing that we have a culture that's focused pretty much on everything but what really matters.
Yeah.
Because if we focused on what really matters, human freedom and human flourishing on an individual level, all these other things that people are focused on would just be, gone. They'd just fall by the wayside. And I know there are probably a lot of people out there that don't believe that, and they want to continue down their path of focusing on these, what I see as non-essentials. But just look at the how entrenched human coercion is in our society. Mm-hmm. It's really at the foundation. I mean, even in this article, the author says there's much debate over whether children should simply follow their intellectual inclinations, be quote unschooled, or be forced to learn core facts and concepts and demonstrate cultural literacy. Now notice the phrase forced to learn. Then they say a quote here. Even Bill Gates says you can't program computers without basic knowledge, says this researcher. It is clear that a foundation is necessary for building up knowledge upward and outward, and that natural interest in doing so is also vital. In other words, both sides are right. So this is that just combination that is so toxic for us, combining principles of human flourishing, unschooling in this case, with coercion, you know, and somehow seeing those things as compatible rather than mutually exclusive.
Oh, absolutely. It's the whole Khan Academy problem. Like, how can we use this technology and this revolution of Khan Academy to help the schools, right? Like, you didn't realize that you have the future here. You have the replacement. You have the thing that makes an 150-year-old factory system irrelevant. We don't need, you know, a meeting with Bill Gates to figure out how this can be used to quote-unquote revolutionize government schools. That was really kind of like, I was very excited about the whole Khan Academy alternative education world that surrounded it.
Yeah.
But that kind of took the wind out of my sails as far as that was concerned. It just shows that, like, how revolutionary does something have to be in the realm of giving people the ability to teach themselves, to become self-leaders, really, that people are finally going to say, oh, all this old stupid shit, we don't need this anymore. You know, this is
exactly.
Not only is this outdated, but it's destructive. I mean, look at the results.
Coercion is not helping people flourish.
Exactly.
And if you do an experiment and if you could do this, take the same person and put them in a coercive schooling system and see how they flourish there versus in this environment of being an autodidact and unschooled and pursuing your passions, the same person would be quite different, I think, through those two routes. Now, you might say that, well, the schooling system toughens them up and they build this immune system of consciousness, as we were talking about earlier, but what's the opportunity cost there? You know, that's what's not being considered. Unfortunately, we have this experiment going on in the millions, and there's just, you know, a relative handful of people that are going the independent route. So what's the cost on society as a result of the squelching of the native intelligence in people? Because you really can't find out all the facets of intelligence. I mean, the one that I give is the main definition for conceptual clarity is just one component. I think it's vital because we need to figure out these basic philosophical things so we can get our society on the rails and not be in this world of coercion and bullshit anymore. Mm-hmm. You know, how else could we cultivate these other facets of our intelligence when we go on these independent paths? You know, we don't even know, you know, the untapped intelligence in people because they've not been in a world in which their own individual flourishing is really respected.
Right. And I think a lot of the freedom conversation or the emergence of a voluntary world is moot without these other considerations. I think for that kind of world to emerge, these things have to be integral in that.
Mm-hmm.
The final part of that article that I was interested in, what's holding you back? It's neither intelligence nor technique that holds people back from being successful self-taught learners. It's insecurity. Feelings of inadequacy stop curiosity. What matters is their openness toward developing their skills and talents. Feelings of inadequacy stop curiosity.
Yeah. And so if you take an IQ test and you don't do so well, say you score like a 95, below average, what is that going to do to your sense of adequacy or your sense of competence or ability, you know?
And how many equivalents do we get in the whole school experience? I mean, I have 12 years of stories like that. C, D, F,
there
detention.
You go. Those are the normal IQ tests that are delivered daily, weekly, yearly, right?
Right. So I think the defenders of IQ or intelligence testing would say, well, you're dealing with something that's much more balanced and objective. I mean, grades are like, I think, a step below that. You know, I mean, that is just so subjective. I remember the great quote on grades that you read to me like 7 or 8 years ago.
I put it in Complete Liberty Inside Out, too.
Right. I'll find the quote. I'll put a link to it in the show notes. But it's just like, you know, 5 or 6 printed lines about here are all the problems inherent in grading in school. But that's how we're measuring ourselves. I guess there's other things like class rank, the way classes are organized into levels. You know, I was never in the highest level until, I was never in the highest level. I didn't perform well in high school. I wasn't excited.
And did anyone ever tell you that that doesn't matter at all in terms of your human flourishing?
No.
In terms of your happiness, in terms of your self-esteem. I mean, it may have a deleterious effect on your self-esteem if you put weight on it, which it seems like most kids do implicitly or maybe even are encouraged to do.
It was all very subtle. It was just a feeling. It was like, I don't ever remember going home or, you know, riding the bus and saying, you know, I'm dumb. Like, school told me so. But I don't ever remember feeling very capable, you know? I didn't feel like there was a place for me in intellectual life. I never even...
It's like the comparison contest, right? I am not dumb, you know, across the board, but compared to that person, right? I'm not as smart. So therefore, I can see where that person's doing X, Y, and Z, and I'm not. Mm-hmm. So there is that sort of self-talk that can be happening.
Right.
And this is the tragic thing about schooling. You know, this is, and parenting as well, like the different competitiveness aspects that diminish our capacity for self-worth, you know, like, so focusing on the things that really matter, which is, you know, again, the philosophical principles and clarity on those issues that are really important to, you know, advance our society and make it a real civilization rather than a Stanford prison experiment writ large. And the psychological awareness, the self-knowledge, which entails having that motivation to really work on these six pillars and dedicate yourself to becoming more of who you are.
I think in our next conversation, we should talk about in more detail these hurdles and, you know, not just the hurdles to practicing the six pillars or even coming to embrace the six pillars in the first place. Even hearing about them from anywhere, how would you in most situations? Most people don't. But also, once we do know these things, the challenges, there's two more challenges that relate to maintaining those practices, you know, long term, sustaining the six pillars. So we've got four dragons to slay before we're done.
Yes, indeed. That is a big, big challenge. Fortunately, the human animal is able to take on that challenge and deal with it effectively. I mean, that sort of trust in your own mind, your own capacity to take on these challenges and deal with them is part and parcel of the whole gist of self-esteem, right?
Right, absolutely.
To see one's mind is efficacious and one's person is worthy of happiness. Happiness is our birthright. So how do we acquire happiness? What are the objective requirements of happiness? And that dovetails right in with this whole process we were discussing.
Yep. Before you start building something up from the ground, unfortunately, you have to realize the hole that you're in a lot of the times. Parenting, schooling, religious upbringing, obviously the structure of the state, puts people, a lot of people, most people, in a position where they're not ready to build, as well as some biological challenges that human beings have, right?
Indeed. Yeah, there definitely are those. And they can be overcome as well, not as easily, but again, it gets back to living consciously. And the more we can focus on that, the easier this process becomes and the more ways we can be creative about overcoming these obstacles that are seemingly inherent in our own brain's functioning.
Yeah, a teaser for next time.
A teaser.
Turns out we are not so intelligently designed.
Yeah, it's a little kludgy.
Mm-hmm.
We're barely beginning to understand just how powerful our brains are and the subconscious and unconscious aspects of it. So the more light we can shed in that realm, the more we are empowered to do all kinds of things that we perhaps thought we couldn't do.
Sound and color with me in my mind. Sound and
everybody, one last note before we wrap up here today. If you enjoyed today's show, please consider supporting us through our Patreon campaign. You can find the link right in the show notes for this episode. And I'm pleased to announce we're 12% of the way to our goal. Oh, whoops, I did that wrong. It's supposed to be more celebratory. I'm pleased to announce we are 12% of the way to our goal. 88% to go, motherfucker. And I just want to say a quick thanks to everyone who has pledged so far. Christian S., Dave S., no relation, Keegan, Lloyd, Kevin F., LSG Media, Mark H., John S., Troy R., and Jay. Thank you guys so much for chipping in and helping incentivize the creation of shows like the one you just heard. All right, good day.